Good evening and welcome to this special edition of the Hot Seat, coming to you live every Wednesday. And so we're welcoming our listeners all over Uganda, from Vura to Virunga, from Kotido to Kabale. And tonight we'll be looking into a topic of restoring citizen sovereignty in our country, and have three individuals who I suppose are going to make justice to this topic. And we shall also be relying on you at the end so that we can give you an opportunity to express yourself by calling in the last 5 minutes of the show. Let me introduce my guest this evening. I have Mr. Ambrose Asingizibwe, who is the Executive Director, Agriculture Reform Hub, AgroRef Uganda. Ambrose, thank you so much for joining us. Good evening.
Thank you so much, Patrick. I'm happy to meet all of you, and I hope that the discussion will be fruitful to all Ugandans.
I have the Executive Director, Women's Democracy Network, Uganda Chapter, Perry Aritua. Thank you so much for joining us, Perry. Good evening.
Good evening, Patrick, and my fellow panelists and all the listeners. Good evening to you all.
I have a gentleman who's a UPC leadership candidate. I must say he's been a candidate for a while. He's a Pan-Africanist and very passionate and patriotic Ugandan, Mr. Joseph Ocheano. Thank you so much for joining us, Joseph.
Absolute pleasure being here, Patrick. But guess what? I just can't believe it's nearly 20 years since I was last in this street. This street is very particularly, they've got special stuff for me. This is the first major studio in Kampala when I returned from exile. So.
Yeah, by the way, talking about that, because sometimes we... introduce you in very many capacities. Let me be very. Yeah. I want to be as clear as possible. Exactly. What is your title? What do you do, Joseph Ocheano, with all respect?
I'm a permanent spokesperson for Milton Obote.
What is that supposed to mean? He's a man who died long time ago. It's not like he's going to tell you something to speak for him.
No, Milton Obote, the idea, and the idea is Uganda People's Congress. So. I am a full-time UPC activist. It's my intention to do so until Uganda is fully free, independent, and sovereign. For the moment, you've called me jokingly, but quite seriously, as a leadership candidate. I should be the president of Uganda People's Congress. I won elections over 5 years ago, and thankfully part of the incompetence is the matter has been in court for 4.5 years. A matter of judicial review that should have declared me president, issued a permanent injunction against Jim McKenna, taken me to Uganda House, and today you'd have the ninth candidate in the presidential race. And of course, you would be seeing real old Santu programs. And I'm delighted to have an agriculturist here whose programs, if a UPC government was in charge, you would see
this
a revolution.
This UPC government is so passionate about. Let me ask, you know, when you entered in here, somebody said, you know what, that gentleman is so passionate about UPC, he's always in UPC colors. What was he in the UPC government? I said, he must have been a young man at that time. Let me ask, how old were you? What were you doing when Obote was in government the last time he was?
I was a very ordinary young man. Today is December 10th, so 45 years ago, I voted, just having turned 18 from June, for my first election, and I was a young student in Busoga College, Miri. So I met Obote during the 1980 general election campaigns when he came to Miri, Semugero came to Miri, and candidate Museveni came to Miri. The early part of Obote, other than being an activist student of National Union of Students of Uganda, I really didn't hold any other position.
Can you imagine that during the Obote presidency, Joseph Ocheano was so passionate about Obote, was a teenager?
Because he actually, he wowed me, and I was telling Perry
extraordinary.
He wowed me with convictions and ideals, and those are more relevant today than it was at the time.
You never actually saw the Obote in power. As in to really, because you were a young person when he was.
No, in a way, obviously, Obote too, I was a young student, and by the time of the coup in 1985 in July, that one found me at the taxi park in Kampala. I was on my way to Tororo to prepare to return to Makere in September, so the coup found me there. So unfortunately, I was one of those people who are neither here nor there, and so I didn't know Obote the man. I only got to know Obote the man in exile, and I'm delighted also to say that Obote the man... once upon a time, after I'd come, I think, from Sky Television, I got a phone call, and it was from one of his aides, Stephen Miller, who was head of youth desk in the 60s, saying, "When I be take, Mzee wants to speak to you." So a bit of a surprise, but no, it's because I was just doing the right thing for this.
So you're holding on about the idea?
About the idea.
All right. So, Perry Aritua, tell me about your organization, Perry. I'm doing this so that our listener can understand the kind of panel I have this evening.
All right.
And the expertise you bring.
All right. So the Women's Democracy Network is a women's rights organization, and our focus is mainly to ensure that women have a platform to be able to participate in leadership, particularly political leadership. So we focus on identifying young talent, like those who are budding in political parties. We work with all the political parties to ensure that where they have, like, young people who are interested, they're able to have an opportunity to be mentored, to be trained. Because, Patrick, I'll tell you that in this country, there's not much investment in training leaders, especially
but you know, I don't know why you have special attention to women. We have a constitution that mm-hmm. actually gives them special attention. We have affirmative action that is supposed to boost their capacity, mm-hmm. and this has been happening for the last 30 years. Yes. You know, they are very focused and very, you know, attending to the women issues. Why do you think that's not enough, or it is misguided?
I think it's not enough because if you look at, one, the population of this country is largely female, and I think by about 2018 or 2020, the ordinary Ugandan was a 14-year-old girl. Now, in the last census, the majority of Ugandans are 17 years. You know, I think about 50% are actually 17 years. So that tells you that it's like every other year we are churning out new voters. Now, why we focus a lot on women, and increasingly we're actually also focusing on male youth, because they're also a big demographic which is present in the politics of this country, is to ensure that when they get into leadership, they are doing certain things right. And most people wonder, but you're a civil society organization, and we partner a lot with the political parties, but also exceptional leaders across the political party lines.
Okay, let me go to Ambrose very briefly before we dig deep into the issue of restoring citizens' sovereignty. You know, Ambrose, you're talking about, you know, your director agriculture reform hat. We are an agricultural country. How do you, what kind of reform are you talking about, and where is this reform hub?
For me, the focus on this organization is on agricultural cooperatives. So when I worked as the executive director, chief executive office of the National Alliance of Agricultural Cooperatives, I found out that many cooperatives that were strong in the 1960s, 1970s had lost their credibility. And cooperatives are not an island, they live in Uganda. So they have issues of transparency, issues of accountability, corruption, and management issues and governance. But then they have a lot of power, they bring a lot of people. You find a cooperative like British Cooperative Union, Sebei Ergon Cooperatives, they have a membership of 5,000 people. So they have a voice, but this voice is not guided because of the structure, the corruption of the leaders. So this organization, its role is to make sure that to strengthen the role of cooperatives in management, but also the focus is on other organizations, farm organizations, and the goal is...
Cool. You know, talking about your taste, what does the serving government do? What do the citizens have got to do? What do they get in return? In my opinion, that in the broadest sense is of it. And finally, if you don't mind, a situation in which the person controlling the budget is you, and you're planning for your people, not Pinetti, not Pinetti.
But you know, you talked about today, 1945, I mean, 45 years ago today, there's a letter that has been moving around on the media, Terry, and written by, purportedly, I think Yoweri Museveni, is writing to the chairperson of the Electoral Commission, I think somebody called it Kikira. If you look at the complaints of the candidate of UPM in that letter, you may think it is a letter written by Robert Chagulanyi today.
Yeah.
Today. And I'm still trying to ascertain the authenticity of whether actually it is authored by Yoweri Museveni. And when you look at also what UPM got then in the results of that election, you may think that maybe even Mabirizi has a chance sometime later, because he's in the doldrums in terms of polls. But again, it shows you that Uganda has not changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the players could have changed, but the situation has remained the same.
True.
The complaints of Robert Kyagulanyi and other people now were exact complaints of Yoweri Museveni.
Although those ones were unfounded, these ones are real.
In 1980, what do you think of that?
That means we have not learned from history. And it's unfortunate because you now have a bigger population, a younger population, which is interested. The advantage we have is they are interested in leadership. They want to participate. And it's hinged in our constitution because power should actually lie with us Ugandans. They want to participate. But if you're creating all these obstacles, making it difficult for them to associate with a party of their choice, making it difficult for them to speak out, you know, having them censoring themselves, having civil society almost too scared to even sign a statement when they see blatant violence, where accreditation of CSOs to observe the election is almost non-existent. These are things we have not seen.
But Ambrose, you know, at the very beginning, you seem to have suggested that we have not had sovereignty. Even we cannot restore something we have not had. Some of the panelists disagree with you. Where do you come from? Where are you bringing that idea?
It contains sovereignty to election. Is justifying Museveni's current state of affairs. Because Mr. Ocheno is trying to justify that Ugandans have had sovereignty before, based on the 1980
elections. No, based on elections and the deliverables following elections, and that the people had the mandate, and that the elections were credible and represented the views and opinions of the people at the time.
And that's exactly
correct.
Yes. Even the current government will tell you that since 1996, Ugandan citizens have voted us into power. And they would say that is sovereignty to Ugandans. For me, democracy is beyond elections. Democracy is a culture. Mm. Democracy is a DNA that is embedded in the people, and it's a struggle. So to me, someone would argue that is elections a way to democracy, or it is an end in itself? So we have to define, are we Ugandans ready for democracy? Because if you look at the situation, past regimes, and Uganda recognizes in its preamble to the constitution, and I'm going to read one note from former Justice, Chief Justice Benjamin Odochi, The Search for National Consensus, and he says, and I think this will, beneath its technical details lies, he talks about the constitution because he was the chairperson of the commission.
Mm-hmm.
He says that beneath its technical detail lies a real testimony to a Ugandan moment of hope and real struggle with democratic possibilities and a promise that some say no longer exists today, particularly because there are signs of strong currents of infidelity to the spirit that bred and nurtured the constitution-making process. Now, this is a person who chaired the constitution-making process, but he's actually current in this book saying that the spirit of the constitution has been lost, that there it has been ripped. That is the farthest word I can use, because infidelity is that you're cheating on your partner whom you have had vows to stay with and be faithful to that person. So this is the person who led the commission to draft this constitution, and democracy is hinged on a constitution, and we have a constitution, but we don't have a spirit and the culture of constitutionalism. And
of course, what you missed there is that the 1995 constitution, you know, was promulgated in a space in which political parties had been banned.
Ambrose, Terry, and Joseph, gentlemen and lady, hold on to your points because we're going to take a break. When we get back, let's try to see how we can restore. In the hot seat, my name is Patrick Amara, my guest this evening. I have the executive director of Agriculture Reform Hub, AgroRef, Mr. Ambrose, I think is here. I have the executive director of Women Democracy Network Uganda, Teddy Aritua, and I have a Pan-Africanist and a UPC leadership candidate, Mr. Joseph Ocheno. So you actually said that the problem is we lack some kind of fidelity in our democracy. In other words, we have infidelity in our democracy. So how do we restore fidelity? Because the constitution as we have it is a very good document. My thinking is that we just need to stick to it. Even the little bit that has been mutilated about it, if only we can just stick to it, despite the mutilation, it can still deliver us, and it can still can keep the promise.
You know, if you read the constitutional making process, specifically in this book, you understand the spirit behind the constitution.
It's captured in the preamble.
Yeah. The spirit actually
is... We the people.
Mm.
A constitution that was not funded by Ugandans. This is a document that actually during the constitution making process, they lacked funds. Danida was supporting, America was supporting, Canada was supporting. You get it? This is a document that should be owned and facilitated by Ugandans, but it was being supported by countries we thought that we had divorced from, because we call them colonial.
So you see some clauses that are more American and more Danida-ish?
Partly that, but also partly the other thing was the agenda of the Constitution. The Constitution was designed to cleanse.
Exactly, it was the social contract that they say this is what will govern us.
Is there a problem with the fund, the money they put in the Constitution making
process? Most of the clauses of our Constitution are drawn from international instruments and regional instruments. Uganda is part of the African Union.
Yeah.
If you look at the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, you look at the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance, we have borrowed heavily. And also, I know that for the first time, we're involved in saying this is how we want to be governed, you know. And that's why when there have been certain tweaking of the Constitution, you've heard people saying, but what happened to what we agreed? So even if maybe there was funding from other sources, largely the process was Ugandan. And I think if there is any change that needs to happen to the Constitution, it's important to go back to that initial process where the citizen was saying, this is how I want to be
governed. I know, Joseph, of people who have traveled to Kampala to come here and benchmark on the Ugandan constitution when it had just been promulgated in 1995, because the whole world lauded Uganda for putting together a very good supreme law for the land.
But what the whole world forgot was that the constitutional making process, the constitution being nice, the process being generally good, was done at the back of Ugandan citizens that were not wholly free and democratic from my perspective. You know, the people who initially went through from starting 19, and you can look at the report from 1989 in a justification of a monolithic system.
But by 1995, you belong to a group of people who had lost power 10 years back.
No, Lucy,
I'm not expecting you.
Actually, that's very interesting.
Yes.
Can I come into that?
Yes.
Can I come, because we're discussing sovereignty. One of the most atrocious things Ugandans have done is that in 1971, when the elected government of the people was overthrown, you know, people called it Obote government overthrown, when actually their constitution had been overthrown and the government elected with their mandate had been overthrown. You know, by the way, not surprisingly, they regretted. In 1985, when the democratically elected government was overthrown, you know, people clapped, and some of the clappers went ahead to work with the Pinetis of this world to try and fudge a process in which to justify militarism.
And I hope people should remember that it is not the NRA under Museveni that overthrew Obote.
They were.
No. His own generals who toppled him.
That's why it's good to have this composition.
Mm.
NRA, DP, a certain religious establishment using some individuals in the army overthrew them.
Yeah, what I'm saying, Obote's generals who toppled him. Whether they were in compromise or whatever,
those,
it is generals.
No, those are.
Yes, Museveni was on their heels.
No.
Pursuing them was hot on the hot pursuit, but it is General Tito Kello.
They're not about his generals. The Uganda National Liberation Army, for which Mr. Museveni was the vice chairperson, the National Army was not about his army. The NRA is closely, almost certainly, Museveni's army. So that's the difference.
Yes,
Number two, let me just clarify. When the government was overthrown in 1985 July, it was a deal between DP, a religious establishment, using the army, plus a few guys in Uganda People's Congress. Yes, Tito Kello and Basilio Kello were in UNLA. But NRA was part of the game. They just fought amongst themselves, broke Kampala in 6 months. By the time one group of militias took over on January 25th, 1986, Kampala was broken, and the militia that took over was Mr. Museveni. They had to try and fudge illegitimacy and claims of entry of this country. Went ahead, IMF, World Bank, and so some people told them that, well, design a new constitution, frame yourselves, eventually come in 1985 here.
The only
constitution in the world I know, which was designed with political parties in prison, is the Ugandan constitution. I'm not saying it's a bad constitution, but Ugandans need to recognize that. We are discussing
You know, Joseph, what is very interesting is that you were just an 18-year-old then when Ubuntu was being shown the exit from the
power. I was 18 in 1980.
Okay, but even then, so you were a 23-year-old. When Obote was being shown the
evidence. And a very good reader.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, quite a relatively young man. Perhaps even Perry was not there at all. And so, example was, I was around, but I could not fathom what was happening when he was leaving. But what I know and what I've been reading is that there was some kind of a sigh of relief across Uganda.
Not in Tororo, not in Gulu, not in Kabale.
There was a sigh of relief that people talk, that you know what, that sanity had been restored, that people felt they had the power, people felt that you know, that dignity is back, Ambrose. That has been documented.
If you read the Martin Meldes' book, The State of Africa, A History of the Continent Since Independence, he will tell you how Idi Amin was taken as a savior when he took over power. He will explain that very well. And that is the relationship citizens have had with every president that comes and promises heaven on earth and later turns against them.
But then that means the status quo that is expunged has a problem at that moment.
I didn't know.
No, not really. Patrick, you're undermining the power of the fourth estate, the media. You're undermining the power of imperialism. You're undermining the power of the forces. Milton Obote's one government was overthrown by global Western powers, and you know what they come with. Milton
Obote II was of the villages in Western Uganda or in Central Uganda here and talk about Yoweri Museveni.
I thought
he has a spell on them when they look back in 1980.
Because
you and I, we may not be able to fathom what they went through. But believe you me, when you look at those elder women, they have Museveni put a spell on them because they think he changed Uganda for better.
But you know what happened in 1966. You as a journalist, you also need to go ahead and investigate what Museveni did in Luweru, including putting on UNLA uniforms and claiming that UNLA guys had killed them. Of course, in 1980s, Uganda had grievances with the UPC and Milton Obote. That is true. Part of Western Uganda, Museveni went ahead and did whatever havoc he did. You know, you guys in the fourth estate need to go ahead and establish how Museveni built the base on that. In any case, the guy had lost elections in Barara, went to break because next year he in Kampala. No, by 1985-86, people thought the problem was Milton Obote. You guys as a fourth estate and part of this conversation about sovereignty, we need to make sure that we investigate and establish the truth. Propaganda is one thing.
Okay.
Truth and facts is another.
Ambrose, your thinking is very radical. So where do we get back? Where do you think we lost it?
Okay.
So for you, we never even had it. So what do we need to do? We never had the sovereignty.
Democracy is about the people themselves. Mm. Because you look at the demographics of Uganda, what kind of people do we have? What is the for example, in Kalamoja, the people who are in the subsistence sector and 70%, the poverty rates are there. Now, someone like that who is thinking about the next meal tomorrow does not conceive the reality of democracy. So, the society as Uganda, the people, I believe in my view, because I am a public policy analyst, a largest percentage of people cannot conceive what democracy means, because their needs are different from what democracy provides. They are thinking about, we were doing an interview in Barara 2 weeks back, and I went to Wizwera Health Center 4, and I went to their Petra trains, and this is sad, but you went to the Petra, and it was all littered I saw the same experience in Villa District Headquarters, and if you still have a population
that consumers consolidated
that their needs and is actually teaching them how to do that. Now, you cannot expect such a person to have the mental capacity to conceive.
And they're being told to protect that.
Oh, that's very radical. So in other words, I think what you're saying, Perry must be very unhappy with you.
Because
for you, you're fighting for democracy.
My perception is
perhaps we actually don't need this.
No. It's because democracy must deliver tangible benefits for the people. Mm. And that's why when you elect leaders, there are certain responsibilities that they have. Mm. You know, if you, my father was a community development officer, and he tells you they use not to actually sit in offices.
That's correct.
In the community to educate the community. And remember, we had civics in school.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it was the civic consciousness, because the thing is, citizens must make a relation between the leaders and how democracy delivers. Because if an election, for instance, is rigged, you have then taken away that power from the citizen. But when you have leaders who are elected and they are accountable and resources are being put to the right use, then citizens will see the tangible benefits of democracy.
Talking about citizens, Joseph, I think for democracy to thrive, then the citizens must be able to engage. We must have higher civic competence, where people can be able to ask the questions, know their responsibilities, know their rights, and have a higher degree of integrity. Because if that is lacking, maybe the leaders we put in places of positions of leadership can take us for granted. So how do we build, you know, a civic competence for Uganda that is watertight?
It's a combination of what Ambrose is saying and Perry is saying, and what we said much earlier, the question of leadership. And that's where I then get boring. I take us back to the times when there was genuine community work, including on roads. Mm-hmm. I take us back to when it was possible in every village, from Karamoja to Kotido, Karamoja to Katuna, you know that they'll guarantee Ugandan access to basic health. And you know that someone will be stranded in any village in Uganda, and there'll be a local community development officer or a health officer or a local chief. They will get involved in one way or another. And by and large, that will be delivered for people. And that's one of the reasons why I say that actually I believe there has ever been an attempt for this to create spaces for citizens to have sovereignty. And if there is a leadership that thinks for people, that can sound patronizing, but that's the nature of democracy and governance, that political parties and organizations come with a big idea. They think on behalf of the people, they sell these ideas, then they run with it, radically, and programs in terms of big infrastructure, education, health, and others. Patrick, can you imagine that in 1970, the primary living exams results showed that Bukedi, was the best performer in PLE with 96.6%. And you know the second district? The second district then was Karamoja with 96. You know, just think about it. So something was happening then, but something has radically happened in the last 40 years particularly. And that is part of the conversation we need to be able to have. Now, but you're right. I am lucky with pain that I experienced something functioning in this country before. But I'm also lucky with pain that exile that pushed me outside my country made me go ahead and experience democracy. And I engaged. I have been a parliamentary chairman of a British Labour Party, a governing Labour Party. And I chaired a meeting during the Iraqi war. And I saw how party members came and shouted and banged tables, demanding that their government should not go to war. I saw policies change. I have also had an opportunity where a minister writes to me and seeks my opinion, both as a party member, Labour, but also including the UPC leader when they want to go to
That's when you have a vibrant system.
But if you don't mind, that's part of what Perry is trying to do in terms of the organization. And that's why I'm impressed by some of what the work Ambrose is trying to do. For us, political parties, that's part of our problem. That right now we're struggling with the leadership. We don't know where we create a civic environment in which, to answer your questions, citizens genuinely nationally go ahead and do what I used to do in primary and secondary school,
Joseph, Perry, and Ambrose, gentlemen and lady, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask, how is it that the Chinese Communist Party, which is not largely not even a democracy, is delivering for the Chinese, is delivering for the world. In fact, it has even overtaken the United States. We have people or leaders in this region whom you may think are not as democratic as you may think, but they are delivering for people and for their citizens. Maybe this democracy thing, we are living a lie. We'll be right back. My name is Patrick Amara. My guest tonight, I have Mr. Ambrose Asingizigwe, Terry Aritua, and Mr. Joseph Ocheno. You know, before we took a break, I was wondering, Ambrose, the Chinese Communist Party, you cannot say they're a democracy. Their parliament, I think, meets once a year. But China seems to have delivered for its people. Mm-hmm. The economy is surging forward.
Yeah.
Now the second largest economy, probably likely to overtake the United States in a couple of years, if they haven't done that already. We have examples here in Africa, here in our region, where you could say maybe some of these leaders are not so democratic. You know, when they go to the election, they hit 99% or something like that. But you guess what? They are delivering for their people, and things, there's order, things work. When you go to our streets, downtown Kampala, we live in everyday anarchy. Everyday anarchy. You know, the city is in a mess. Like as a Ugandan, I don't like it. It is in a mess. And I even don't know the leaders themselves, they disregard the laws, so are the borders and everybody. And this is where we are. And yet we call ourselves democracy. Maybe we are living a lie. We need a benevolent dictator.
I'm going to read for you a statement that was aired out by the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda, when she was resigning. She said, "I no longer have enough in the tank to do the job. It's time I'm leaving, because with such a privileged role comes the responsibility to know when you are the right person to lead, or when you are not. I know what this job takes, and I know that I no longer have enough in the tank to do it justice. It's simple as that." Now, I think for most part of Africa, our leaders don't have that in their DNA to recognize that I can no longer deliver on the promises I made. But then, going back to China, I think it comes to leadership. As the saying goes, that everything starts with leadership. So a leader, for example, in most African contexts, it's the military people or other people that have come up and waged a coup. But then the problem is that when they come, they don't give away the power to the people. They want to keep the power to themselves, all of it. And I think it's deliberate, because in the context of Uganda, it is easier to govern or rule the ignorant in that context. So a good leader, like Chinese have done, you have read, you have been seeing videos of the former Prime Minister of Singapore. When they had a pandemic of spitting. Is this spitting? The population was like normal. And he made sure that culture stopped, because he wanted his country to be a hub for international destination. So a leader must be willing to make sure that the people he's leading
can show the way.
Exactly, show them the way. Because sometimes these are things that are normal to us, like speaking to them was normal to them. It was part of their culture. But a good leader who had traveled outside knows that this is not good for the rest of the world, whom we need to come here and develop our country. So every leader must be willing to give out some power, that privileges, and let his people, all her people, be able to be emancipated from the ignorance, empower them. So the leader, in most cases, our context here, our leaders have failed on that. They are not willing to civilize their people.
Okay. Terry, I want to see sovereignty and democracy plus economic development for nations. If you're a sovereign nation, then probably you are democratic, and probably if you're democratic, then you have a better economy.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years back, most political analysts, probably even including ours truly here, Joseph, was giving us the example of Ghana and example of Botswana.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at those countries today, that were the shining examples on the hill of democracy, today their economies, they are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So you wonder, what happened?
Yes, and I think that during the break I was just saying Botswana right now is dealing with a huge problem of corruption, and actually the president has said that anyone who will be found culpable must pay the price. So there must be a level of commitment of the leader to say, if this happens, regardless of whether you're my brother or my son, you'll serve as an example, because that sets the pace. Now, I wanted to just speak a little bit about legitimacy, because it's so critical, and that's why the power of the citizens become important in giving the leader legitimacy. When you're legitimate, citizens follow you without you demanding for respect, for love. They will even sweep these roads without you saying anything. I've been to places in this country where when NADS was operational, you would find farmers saying, those are NADS goats and those are my goats. And when you dig deeper, that means they don't own these things. Yet this is money from the taxpayer. So for me, and that's why I say that elections serve a critical purpose.
But in some cases, you receive more NADS signposts than real NADS.
Exactly. And that's why, Patrick, elections serve a critical purpose, because the citizen then chooses the leader, and they're able to own some of the things that the leader tells them to do. They are able to work with the leader. You talked a little bit about China. China is a country we must study a little bit more. I've had an opportunity to listen to people who have worked with the Chinese government and lived in China. They will tell you that at the lowest levels, at the local levels, like the LC level, you cannot get into that position if your background is such that you have not made any difference. You only move from LC1 to LC2 if you're able to show tangible benefits. And the community, the citizens, actually have a very big say in who becomes their leader at that level, because it's your tangibles in terms of roads, in terms of healthcare, in terms of education, that take you to the next level. So for me, it's a question of us going back to the drawing table, and the leaders really being committed to the ideals in our constitution and being able to let it go. I mean, if the people are saying, we don't want you to be our leader right now, let it go. And that's why, if you read the statement of the chairperson of the Electoral Commission when he was talking about how the military is getting engaged in some of these processes, you cannot edge out the one who is in charge of conducting, supervising an election, and you hope that at the end of the day you'll win the people's favor. You don't beat people to love you. You persuade people to lead.
What do you make of what happened in 2021 in the elections, when the National Unity Platform, a new kid on the block, swept the entire Buganda region, swept the entire Busoga region, changed the leaders, and then they had a voice, and their voice was heard, and they told whoever was there, the members of parliament, no, and happened.
Yeah.
Isn't that the power of the people?
Yes,
the democracy.
It can happen.
Isn't that so that where you have you were best, the best will stand. We have seen it. It's standing here. 5 years ago, it did that. Though they called it a red wave, nobody survived it. If you want to do something else.
Yeah, and in a way, possibly that's one of the reasons why people are being beaten up now.
Actually, they were beaten more the other time, including the presidential candidate himself.
No, but don't forget that we still have a month or so to go.
Oh, there's
and
still some beating.
And we just hope that we don't see and experience more of those. An interesting thing. As Perry was talking, I remember two things. Milton Obote told told Julius Nyerere in 1975, apparently over a meal with Mama Miria and her colleague listening, that's important for us to let go when we're still popular. Obviously, it was an exile. Nyerere was in power. Nyerere managed to let go. I really hope that some African leaders can listen and let go when it's time. Milton Obote didn't have the time to do so, he was pushed away. But number two, also in 2002, Milton Obote told me at his balcony in Lusaka that twice when he was president, Ambrose, that no member of his close family was allowed to hold a bank account abroad. Now, that is leadership, that is exemplary, the kind of discussion we're having, including the question of corruption in Botswana. But that also links up with part of what Perry is saying, including about China. Patrick, it happened in this country. The problem for you is that I'm slightly older. I saw it. The early days of an average Mutaka chief from outside Buganda. In Buganda, the criteria would be that you are loyal to the king. But predominantly outside Buganda, most of the lower level chiefs, you know, you'll have to be predominantly men, a man of integrity and a man of repute. And I also have the former head of the Uganda Human Rights Commission, I think, former minister Ali Romara, who told me that in 1980, he was a young lawyer, and in the morning he just found a delegation of elders who came to him and say, young man, you know, elections are taking place and we want you to be the candidate for to represent us in parliament.
Okay.
That is integrity. That is how systems were working, rural at the time. Business was then not about money, personality, whoever. It was about integrity, culture, leadership, and systems.
These
things can actually happen.
Interesting
in this
thing, gentlemen,
yeah,
and lady.
It can happen.
Let me give you an opportunity to each one of you to make your concluding remarks. Let me begin with you, Ambrose.
For me, I want to congratulate all Ugandans on the International Human Rights Day. Uganda today marks the International Human Rights Day, and we had the last session today at the golf course led by Uganda Human Rights Commission. For me, I say that Ugandans, we all have a stake in Uganda, progress and movement. And whether you're in power, whether you're not in power, you have a role to play. And for me, I say the government should invest in education, because a civilized, an educated society, yes, have the power and the will and the stamina to demand for services. But if we keep our population in ignorance, then this will take us more than 200 years to achieve. So for me, invest in education, invest in agriculture, because we still need food. 200, 1,000 years from now, we still need food. The government should put in a lot of money, not these small monies. So for me, I call upon Ugandans to embrace Uganda. It's the only country we have, and we can never have another one. So embrace it and love it and promote it.
Thank you, Ambrose Perry. In 30 seconds, your parting shot?
My parting shot is, let especially the leaders who in Article 20 are supposed to safeguard the rights of Ugandans by promoting and protecting them, live up to those principles. Our constitution is only given life if we practice the principles and values that are enshrined in it. And for me, I would urge the citizens to continue to make their voices heard, because civic engagement is very important in transforming communities. If you sit and keep quiet over things that should be done differently, it will not change. So they should continue to make their voices heard. They should continue to participate, because there's no other country that they have. All of us, this is the only country many of us know. And I think ultimately, let the actors, especially for me here, I'll talk about the security forces, let them just stop beating Ugandans.
Well, so then you're talking about the only country we have, but Joseph has another one for spare.
I do not.
The United Kingdom.
No, I do not have another country. I'm not a citizen of the United Kingdom. I refuse the citizenship.
Your party,
I think the guys in NRA must be very disappointed that I refuse that citizenship. No, my only republic is Uganda, and I'll protect it jealously. Look, as we discuss human rights today, actually, it's a little shame that we've seen the pictures recently. We hope that between today and the elections, that there are no more beatings of candidates, there are no more beatings of citizens, and let Ugandan citizens freely, including across political parties, not putting provocative uniforms, go to listen to candidates in various camps and make a decision to vote for whoever their leader is. But I hope that at the end of the day, whatever happens, we shall get a government that will be a government of the people, emancipation of the people, and a government which is not a stooge, and a government which is not a quisling regime, and a government which is not a nyampala on behalf of other forces, a government that is genuinely sovereign for the people of Uganda.
Joseph Ocheno, thank you so much. Mr. Perry Adetua, thank you so much. And Ambrose, I think, I want to thank you, gentlemen and ladies, for the energy, for the submission you've given us, for the passion that I feel in your voice, for passionate about Uganda. Thank you so much.